Hi, I'm Charlie, and this is Stereo Hysteria. Our March Artist of the Month, Matthew Smith, is a musician who's been active in the Detroit music scene for over three decades, most notably as main songwriter in the psychedelic pop band, Outrageous Cherry, who released their 11th album, The Digital Age, last October. He's also a founding member of the Volbeats, a legendary alt-country group, and has produced albums by artists as diverse as The Go, Andre Williams, and the late, great Kim Fowley. Stereo Hysteria spoke with Matt via telephone at his home in Hamtramck, and we'll be hearing excerpts from that conversation over the next hour. But let's start off with a track from Outrageous Cherry's 2006 album, Stay Happy, called Memphis Stereo.
So, hey, what's happening, man?
Yeah, I've just been listening to your music all day. I didn't realize that the discography went back so far and was so wide-reaching.
Yeah, you didn't realize we've been around as long as the Benny Goodman Orchestra. You know, I can't remember exactly when it started, but it was something like 91, 92. I needed to make a demo for somebody who wanted to hear my songs. Actually, it was the guy who was managing The Replacements or Paul Westerberg at the time or something, and had heard a tape of me playing acoustically and was like, you know, oh, I want to hear this guy with a band, you know, and I went and tried to play my songs with a bunch of musicians playing stuff in a kind of normal manner, and it was all really boring to me. And then I just kind of picked out three musicians that I thought were really, really individual sort of players who didn't know each other and put them together in a room. And then the minute we started tuning up, I noticed that it sounded like a band before we were even playing songs. You know, I just heard the sound. All of a sudden, there was this sound there, you know.
Mm-hmm. And at that time, you were already a member of the Volbeats.
That's true, yeah.
Those two bands have sort of coexisted side by side for all these years. How do you divide your time and energy between the projects?
Well, the Volbeats kind of started in the late 80s, and, you know, I'd been playing in just numerous bands around Detroit since I was like 13 or 14.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Volbeats started playing, I guess that was the first time that I really participated in a band where I felt that the songwriting was really achieving a level that was as good as my record collection, you know, at times. You know, it sort of set a higher standard for what everyone was doing who was hanging around that band.
Here's a track from the Volbeats' most recent release, a self-titled album from 2010 called You're Wrong.
Flailing on pages, windswept and ageless, I'd be faithless to sing another song, and you're wrong. Waiting in sameness, take hold of your namelessness in vain, and try to be strong, still you're wrong. You're wrong to judge me by what you think I ain't done. You're wrong to begrudge me for trying to have fun. Phrases collapse in daisies. The rising tide sounds are gone, and you're wrong. A wealth of strangeness means so much less than the notion of where you belong, and you're wrong. You're wrong to question me by where I'm coming from. You're wrong to take up my time. You won't give me some.
Happened with the Volbeats was that we just worked very erratically. You know, we would do a whole bunch of work, do a record, and then, you know, one guy would get dragged away in handcuffs by the cops, another guy would be off to the mental hospital, and then, you know, we wouldn't be able to tour. There'd be years between records, and people in the band had day jobs, and so it was sort of like we had some years where we toured all the time and did stuff, and then other times where, you know, it was just really difficult, you know, just to keep things moving. I think that sort of kept me working in other projects. You know, I'd be asked to produce records for other people, and I sort of started producing other artists and things like that. So a lot of it stemmed from the Volbeats just not being that active. And then I had other songs that the Volbeats would either reject or just that just didn't seem to fit the Volbeats, and that kind of, you know, got me thinking, well, I better do something with these. And so then, yeah, like recording that demo, I really didn't intend to start a band, but the minute I got that group of people together, you know, with Larry Ray on guitar and Susanna and Chad, it was one of those weird things where you walked in the room and knew it was a band.
Next, we'll hear the opening track from Outrageous Cherry's self-titled debut album, released in 1994, called Pale, Frail, Lovely One.
Pale, frail, lovely one. The telephone wild eyed precious one. My heart's beating like a drum, only for you to hear.
What kind of music were you listening to that was influencing you? Stuff that was maybe outside of the purview of the Volbeats?
Yeah, I listened to all kinds of stuff. So I was listening to everything from avant-garde classical music to 50s doo-wop and just everything, you know. But I think that when Outrageous Cherry started, you know, I remember listening to the Television Personalities and the Swell Maps and also listening to the Turtles and Love. You know, I think the idea of playing songs that didn't have all of the sonics that had been going on at that time, I think that there was just something about the largeness of 90s music that I just didn't really, I wasn't feeling, you know. And I kind of, once I figured out that I could have a drummer play with me with no cymbals or hi-hat, or a bass drum for that matter, just made the music more spacious. You know, it made it smaller, but not necessarily smaller. It just made it, you know, it was a more condensed structure that had a lot more space in it. And without the hi-hat, you could actually hear the guitar overtones. And it was just, it was so liberating because, especially when Larry and I would play solos with each other, you know, just the guitars sounded different just because there wasn't a hi-hat or cymbals just eating up all the frequencies.
Right. I read an interview once with, I think it was Andrew Bird, and he said he just shied away from cymbals because they're cheap thrills.
You know, I met the guys at Wire one time. I can't remember if they told me this in person or if I just heard them say it in an interview, but I seem to remember the guys from Wire talking about how cymbals are horrible. I think it was Colin Newman. It was just like, yeah, you don't have any cymbals. He's like, oh, cymbals are horrible. And I was like, wow, you know, yeah, they are horrible, aren't they? I mean, I don't really think cymbals are horrible. I mean, when I'm listening to Elvin Jones and Rashid Ali and Sonny Murray, you know, when you're Sonny Murray doing a drum roll on his cymbal, I like that quite a bit. It's just, you know, I don't want a drummer doing that while I'm singing necessarily.
Mm-hmm. And having no cymbals kind of gives it that Phil Spector or Velvet Underground sound.
Yeah, Maureen Tucker and also Peggy O'Neill of the Gorries. I heard the Gorries play in Detroit, and they had no cymbals. You know, at the time when I saw the Gorries, I think it was just kind of like, wow, it's kind of funny that she's playing this drum kit that doesn't have any drums and doesn't have any cymbals. But later on, it was sort of like, wow, that actually is a really useful idea. So, yeah, I mean, I'm sure that listening to the Velvets and seeing the Gorries live, you know, put that idea in my head, you know?
Up next, we'll hear a song from Outrageous Cherry's fourth album, 1999's Out There in the Dark, called Easy Come, Uneasy Glow.
Let's surprises trying to make love now and not be alone. You spend here and there just to sit and stare. Illusions fill the cracks where you go. Easy come, easy come,
went on, a lot of the other kind of musical interests started to come through in the music. And like my guitar player, Larry, who's been with us from the beginning, he started off, his first band was the last incarnation of a Detroit psychedelic band called the Spike Drivers.
Okay.
With a musician named Ted Lucas, who made a record that recently got rediscovered. But Larry had played with this master guitarist who's one of the really great Detroit musicians back in the 70s. And also at that time, he was listening to a lot of really weird European art rock stuff, as well as blues rock stuff like Canned Heat and all kinds of, mm-hmm. you know, he just was listening to stuff all across the board. But that was another thing that was a really big influence on us, both individually over the years, were bands like Can and Aim and Duel 2. Mm. And Larry was, you know, influenced by the French band Heldon and Richard Pinhas. You know, I can hear that in his playing sometimes. So there's a definite European art rock obsession
okay.
that I think started to kind of creep out rather quickly once we started recording. And I don't even think I noticed it at first, you know, but when I listen back to like our first album, I hear it in those instrumentals, you know.
Right.
But that's been a big thing for us too.
We'll continue with a track from 2010's Seemingly Solid Reality, titled Self-Made Monster.
Just a self-made monster. Routine anxiety. Outcast and socialized. Boredom won't set you free. An instinct to distrust, coldness personified. Happy to self-destruct, strictly denied. Your self-made monster, trying to remember, smoke wasted ideal now. Don't it make you feel like a self-made monster?
Have you been a lifelong resident of Detroit?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I live in Hamtramck,
okay.
Which is in the middle of Detroit.
How do you think your geography has influenced your approach to music?
Well, I mean, the Detroit musical identity thing is really a strong... Oh, God, how would I describe it? The environment really affects the musicians here, mm-hmm. and Detroit just has a tendency to produce musicians that are pretty intense individuals. You know, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of, like, you know, bar bands and all kinds of other more typical stuff. But generally, the level of musicianship here is pretty high. And people don't seem to really understand where it comes from, but it's just something to do with the musical environment, the culture. I don't know exactly what produces it. The work ethic, you know, everybody just feels obligated to work really hard at things or something. But the people just develop a, you know, a real edge here, and it's always been that way. It goes, you know, I mean, back in the 40s and 50s, it was like that. There were all these jazz players that sort of stuck around Detroit that didn't really leave, and they were really, really intense. And then, you know, all these guys in the 60s that came along, it's just never really changed, you know.
Yeah.
Some of the bands I've produced, like I produced The Go and another band called The Crooks, you know, these bands just come out of nowhere, and you're just like, whoa, you know, this undercurrent of Detroit weirdness is just really strong in these bands, and, you know, it's this unexplainable X factor, you know.
Here's a song from 2009's Universal Malcontents called Anymore.
Anymore would be much less than I've learned to ignore. Anymore. When days that stumble their way to my door. And are they still there? And do I still care? Anymore than a dream of what's been and what's in store. Anymore. Intrusions, new versions, what I bore. It's easy to see, it won't set you free
mentioned having all of these disparate influences. Your songwriting, it never seems to be derivative. Like from the very start of The Outrageous Cherry, the first self-titled album, it seems like your style was already developed.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. I'm glad to hear that because I was, at the time, I didn't have that many songs. You know, I had these songs that were rejected by the Volbeats. I had other songs I didn't know what to do with. But I didn't have that many of them that I thought were really good. But I had this band suddenly that was able to record a few songs. And it was more like, you know, if you notice, the first album has three instrumentals.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't exactly swimming in lyrics at the moment, you know. And really, I was just sort of hoping, you know, God, if we could just sound as good as the Turtles, and if the guitars could sound as good as a Swell Maps record, then, you know, we're in business, you know. So that's kind of how I felt about it, you know. So it wasn't like we were trying to be original necessarily. I mean, we'd go to rehearsal and we'd play Monkees covers and Trog songs. And I mean, and in fact, our second album's an album of covers.
Mm.
We were doing all these covers and thought, well, maybe we should record those. And then around the time of Out There in the Dark, after the band had been together about 5 or 6 years, at that point, all of a sudden, the songs just started coming on, like, you know, 5 a day, all of a sudden my notebook is filling up with lyrics, and I had no idea where these songs are coming from, and it just took a few years of being in the habit of writing, and then it just went crazy. Suddenly, I became really prolific, and that sort of happened by, you know, that was a surprise after doing the band for, like, several years to suddenly, like, have, like, all these notebooks full of songs, and I'm showing up at practice, you know, like, here's 20 new songs, you know. So that's how that went down, you know. It was a gradual thing, you know. But at that point, I don't think there was really, you know, there was never a thought of trying to be derivative or anything because, you know, when I'd get together with the band, we'd always talk about what records we liked and what records we were listening to.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things about the band is that, you know, everyone in the band is a different age. Like, when we started the band, like, Larry was 10 years older than me. Our bass player was 10 years younger than me. And the drummer was around my age. But consistently through the band, everyone in the band's been 10 years apart from each other in age.
Mm-hmm.
Including right now, our lineup right now, everyone is exactly 10 years apart And so what you end up with, it's people from different generations who have some similar musical sensibilities and interests, which is a lot different than, you know, a bunch of guys who went to high school together.
Sure, yeah.
You know, just playing the music that they're listening to. It's sort of, you know, there are all these different sensibilities from different generations that come into it as well. That's been part of the identity of the band, is this kind of cross-generational thing. And it's just turned out that way, you know. I mean, it wasn't something that was built into it by design. It just kind of happened, you know.
Here's a song from Outrageous Cherry's 2001 double-length psychedelic concept album, The Book of Spectral Projections, titled The Hourglass.
Am I so terribly unfocused? A grain of shadow in a field of locusts. Pulsating in waves to the rhythm of the sun's eclipse. We stare and draw my fingertips. Deep inside. Shifts backwardly and forward, reveals the message you've not yet heard. Use low chance pays the stage of some hypnotic crawls, pictures scrapbooked to the walls, suddenly I face. Nothing much to understand. Drawing out the devil's hand. Trouble galaxies expand. The hourglass is choked with
the most psychedelic Outrageous Cherry album is the Book of Spectral Projections, which I was listening to earlier. Mm-hmm. Listening to it now, it kind of sounds ahead of its time. I would imagine that fans of some of the newer West Coast garage psych bands like the OCs and Ty Siegel would find a lot to love in that album.
Yeah, well, that's a weird one, because at the time we did that, you know, we were following up Out There in the Dark, which everyone tells me is our best album. I mean, whenever people come up to me and tell me what their favorite album is, it's generally Out There in the Dark. Mm-hmm. But we were following up Out There in the Dark, and I just had this weird conceptual, really kind of like a weird rock opera type song cycle thing that was sort of, you know, as much William Burroughs and Brian Gyson flavored as it was, you know, something like Tommy or Quadrophenia or something. Mm-hmm. It was just this weird thing, and I don't know how it all came together, but I just started noticing that all these weird songs I've been writing were just really, really weird, and they all seemed to be interconnected, and I didn't quite know what to do with them, and I just started to put them all together and play them all as a large group of songs, and I was like, well, this is an album. So at that time, we were signed to Pop Tones. We'd been signed by Alan McGee to put out Out There in the Dark worldwide on his, you know, new label after Creation Records and all that. Mm-hmm. When I told Alan that my next album was a rock opera, he just looked at me kind of horrified. Like, oh no, you know, and people were really puzzled, you know, by that record. Like, what the hell are these guys doing? You know, are they nuts? You know, this kind of thing, you know. But that's what I was writing. That's what we came up with. It's just a reflection of where our heads were at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And then probably the next album was a little more normal comparatively. But, yeah, I don't know. You know, it was one of those things where I just felt compelled to write that stuff. And, you know, the recording of it was pretty weird. We went into Jim Diamond's Ghetto Recorders, which was the same place we had done Out There in the Dark. And we recorded it on an 8-track machine, and just the previous one had been on a 16-track, I think. And we just started recording the songs one after the other. And I think we recorded almost all 20 of them in one day. Mm-hmm. By the evening, we had like 17 or 18 of them done. We finished the other couple the next day. After several songs, everyone was kind of in a hypnotic state, and everyone just kind of seemed hypnotized by this current of ideas and music. And by the end of the day, we were just kind of just spaced out, bunch of people laying down all these songs, you know, in one or two takes. And just by the end of the night, the drummer was basically in tears, you know, I want to go home, you know. And I'm like, no, we just got two more songs. I let her go home, and we finished it the next day. But we finished the album really, really quickly. I mean, that record was recorded really fast, and there wasn't any real, thinking behind it. It was just, we just reacted to the ideas, finished it as quickly as we could, and we ended up with this really weird record. Mm.
From 2003's Supernatural Equinox, here's Outrageous Cherry with If You Want Me.
It's true if you're for real. It's hard to believe it's you. I only wanna love you, baby. Can't you see? A place in my mind where I go to think about moments in time. I can't seem to live without. Who will I find when I start dreaming? Will you be there? Tell me what I'm feeling. Oh yeah. If you want me, you can have me.
I think it's a testament to how consistently excellent the quality of your songwriting is that both The New Pornographers and Saturday Looks Good to Me have covered full EPs of Outrageous Cherry songs.
Yeah, that was real nice of them. Yeah, I liked their versions, too. That was real cool. Yeah, I really dug that. Actually, Carl Newman actually covered a song off Supernatural Equinox on his solo tour. Mm. I saw him with this band of, like, you know, 12 people on stage playing If You Want Me, which is one of our songs that's actually harder for us to play because the song, the production is just really large, and he did it on stage, and it just sounded amazing. Mm. I'm like, wow, I wish we could play it like that. And then the Saturday Looks Good to Me, I actually sang on one of their records. I don't know if you know that.
Mm. All your summer songs?
Yeah, I'm on one song on there.
Okay.
And that was fun. That was the only song I've ever recorded on drugs, because I actually don't donate drugs or anything, because it's like, you know, it's hard enough going through life writing all these weird songs in a normal state of mind. But I had broken my arm, so I was on all these painkillers for a broken arm, you know, which mm-hmm. is just not a normal state for me to be in, you know. With the broken arm, I couldn't even put headphones on my head because my arm was in a cast, you know, and I was on this, you know, whatever those pills are they give you when you, you know, so you can't feel anything. Yeah, something like that. So anyway, I was on that kind of stuff when I recorded the Saturday Looks Good to Me song. You know, so I listened back to it. It sounds like I'm on drugs because, you know, yeah, well, that's the explanation.
So nothing but caffeine now.
Yeah, that day, I think, no matter how much coffee I drank, I'm still going to sound like, you know, it goes on a cough syrup binge, you know.
From Saturday Looks Good to Me's superb 2003 album, All Your Summer Songs, here's the track featuring Matthew's guest vocals, No Good With Secrets.
Every time that you shout from across the street, never comes out of sound, just the way you look at me. I always see you hanging out with what kind of gossip and calculations. We've got something to hide on my side of town. No, it's no real surprise, but word gets around. I don't know.
Your new album is called The Digital Age, and when I first heard the name of the album, I took it literally, and I thought it was going to be like really pro-tooled and pristine.
Mm-hmm.
On the contrary, it's got a lot of that analog warmth. It's even mixed in mono.
Yep. I'm glad you noticed that.
What's the recording process like?
Well, on that record, because, you know, some of our records we record in the kitchen with the 8-track. I've got a little 8-track studio in my house, and we rehearse in a kitchen, actually. And so when we record in the kitchen, it's just, you know, setting up the mics and recording and doing some overdubs. But for some of the albums, we've, you know, decided, oh, let's go in the 24-track studio and just make this really grandiose and, you know, bring in the orchestra or whatever we're going to do, you know. And for this one, we recorded it in the house, and this lineup has a real, it's got a really good chemistry. The songs just had a real energy to it. And, you know, when we mixed it, I was going to mix it in mono and mix it in stereo as an experiment, because I just kind of, I think what it was I was listening to a lot of AM radio in Detroit, because we've got this Canadian oldies station in Detroit. It's AM 580. I think you can actually find it online, but it's a Canadian station that plays oldies, but it plays all the really weird, like Canadian records and stuff that was big in the 70s and 60s. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty weird station, and you know, so everybody, all the musicians around here, like, listen to that a lot. And I think I'd been listening to it so much that I just started thinking in mono, and so when we made the record, I mixed the whole thing in mono, and then I sat down to do another mix in stereo, and I was going to basically, you know, just sort of compare them and consider it. It was just an experiment. But by the end of this recording, I just could not bring myself to turn the knobs, to pan things right and left. I just couldn't do it. You know, I just was not hearing it. So the whole record ended up being in mono. The mastering part of the process was done digitally. Some of it through analog equipment and tubes and things like that. But basically the mastering was the digital part of it, and that part of it was really completely excruciating and difficult, because we were trying all these different things with the mastering. And, you know, that part of the process was, that was the part of it where I was confronted with the digital technology that was making me insane, you know. And just, you know, but then we finally got it to where I was happy with it, and I'm like, okay, this works. And so, you know, it was cool. And the album cover actually was a painting that turned up that I had done when I was a little kid. And I took one look at it, and I'm like, oh, well, there's my album cover, you know, The Digital Age. There it is, you know.
And here's the title track to last year's The Digital Age.
1, 2, 3, 4. We'll be right back.
You worked with Kim Fowley, who passed away earlier this year.
Yeah.
How did that collaboration come about?
You know, it was a weird thing where he just heard from a Cream journalist named Ben Edmonds, told him that I had mentioned to Ben that, you know, wow, Kim Fowley's a guy I'd like to work with, because I always loved Kim Fowley's solo records. I discovered his solo stuff in the 90s, and I was just really fascinated by his voice and his lyrics, and just, they're really weird records, and some of it is just this really crazed, freeform stuff, and then some of it is these really fascinating lyrics, and I really dug it, and I just think he's a really great singer. And so he ended up calling me up out of the blue when he heard that I was interested in working with him, and he just, you know, called out of the blue and was like, you know, what do you want to do? I don't want to hear any bullshit. What is it you want? What are you talking about? What do you want to do? You know, this kind of thing. And I'm like, oh, I don't know. I thought we could make a record together. Oh, well, you know, how much money can you come up with? All right, I'll be on the plane, and, you know, I'm going to show up, and, you know, if you don't have half the money, when the minute I get to the airport, man, I'm hopping on the next plane out of there. It kind of went like that, and then he showed up, and we recorded Michigan Babylon. You know, the whole thing just kind of fell together, and he showed up, and we got a bunch of my favorite musicians in town to play on it, and all these people that were fans of his stuff, and we recorded this really good album, and played a gig that kind of turned into a riot that was sort of like Altamont, and then he went back home, and after he left Detroit, after this crazy recording and performance, he became a really good friend, you know, and we just talked to each other like every week for like the last 15 years. Just turned out to be a real good guy and very creative, just amazing intellect. The guy was just really, really cool. And he had kind of a intense persona,
right,
attracted some people and repelled others, but I think that he really needed that to function in that sort of Hollywood kind of environment, you know?
Sure.
And so he came from a weird place, and so it kind of, he had his way of dealing with all that. But he was a really great guy, and then after knowing him for like 15 years, you know, he was having all these like health issues. Mm-hmm. And how we did the more recent record, because I ended up producing his last album, Detroit Invasion, is the last album of his to come out, and he was still alive, you know. And, you know, he was about to go in the hospital to get an operation, and he called me up, and he was really kind of concerned that he wouldn't make it out of the surgery.
Mm-hmm.
So his way of kind of dealing with that was, he told me, he said, look, I want you to book 2 gigs in Detroit a week after the operation. So he wanted something to think about that wasn't medical stuff, you know, and he went in and had this surgery, basically got off the operating table, and 2 days later was flying to Detroit. And then we're in the studio recording songs, and then he's on stage, and we did an acoustic gig, an electric gig, and the gigs that he did at that point, you know, were fantastic. It wasn't like Altamont, like 15 years before, because, you know, it was a different time, different audience, you know, and the audience in 2012 totally related to what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of treated him like he was Iggy or something, you know, like
right.
It was the Stooges. So it was really fantastic, and we had a great recording session, but he was more ill than everyone realized, you know, and I think he kind of knew the way things were going, and just, you know, I thought he was going to come through it and survive because he's just such a tough guy and he's a survivor, you know, but you know, he didn't let us know exactly how sick he was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But it was, no, that Detroit Invasion record was really fun to work on. Mm. You know, that was a blast. You know, I think it's an honor to have worked on his last record, and he got to see the record completed while he was still alive, which
right.
I think meant a lot to him, you know?
Here's the closing track from Kim Fowley's 1998 album, Michigan Babylon, called Detroit 2000.
You told me about Devil's Night and when Motown grooved. So why did everybody leave? Why did everybody move? Tell me where that Nugent went. Why isn't Bob Seger around? Tell me, who shut Car City down? Detroit 2000, may I stay a while? Detroit 2000, it's time for you to smile. You sold me a million golden dreams. So Detroit 2000, may we stay old. joy to a thousand. It's sad for you to smile. Hey now, let's stay together. I hope that you last forever. Remember, don't let Detroit City drift away. I told you what I thought about it. It was time to take a chance. The Red Wings, they finally won. So it's time to make a stand. Detroit 2000. I think we should stay alive. Detroit 2000. It's time for you to smile. It's time, yeah, now Detroit 2000. It's time for you to smile. Detroit 2000. We should stay a while. We should stay a while. We should stay wild, Detroit 2000.
And I saw on the Facebook page that you're already back in the studio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're working on one right now. Actually, we just finished it. We're at the point in the process where I just mixed everything, so I have to go through a lot of mixes. This time, I did do a lot of mono mixes and a lot of stereo mixes. So this time, I kind of tried a bunch of different things, and I did it all this week, and so yeah, like in the next couple of days, I'm going to sit down and start listening to all this stuff, you know. But I just like waited a few days after I mixed it because I want to just get a few days in between where I just can't remember anything that I did, so that I'm surprised when I listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's always better for me with my lyrics or with mixes or with anything to just like come back to it and have no recollection of having done it.
Mm-hmm. So you can judge it like it's someone else's.
That's how it is with the writing, you know. I mean, when I started writing, like, way more lyrics, you know, just lots of lyrics, I'd write these lyrics, and I'd come back to it and really just have no recollection of writing it, really. And then I'd sit down with a guitar, throw a bunch of chords over it, record it onto a cassette, and then I'd forget about that, and I'd come back to it later, and there'd be all these songs on the tape. So there's really, it's not the kind of thing, like, where I read about Keith Richards coming up with a riff and then playing it for, like, weeks before he shows it to Mick Jagger.
Mm.
I mean, these ideas, I really work on them quickly and then work on other ideas afterwards. So by the time I come back to it, sometimes I don't even remember what I was writing about, you know, which I like it that way, you know.
Right.
It's cool.
So should we expect a new album later in the year?
I would like to get it out by September. I mean, you know, I kind of wanted to be touring right about now, actually. But it didn't really work out to get us on the road at this time. So I'm going to try to get us on the road later in the year. But I figure that if we're taking this long to get the band back on the road, that we might as well have another album, you know, because we got the songs and the rest of the group was really eager to just get back in the studio and record some new stuff. So I was like, all right, let's do it. So hopefully, yeah, I wouldn't mind getting something out by the fall.
Excellent. Is that Detroit work ethic at work?
Yep, that's what it is. Yeah. That, and also, you know, it's like really like miserable and cold in Detroit, so it's just like, you know, it's good to lock yourself in a recording studio for an entire week and not just avoid going outside as much as possible.
I hear you. I'm in Chicago at the moment, and it's pretty frigid.
Yeah, this winter is unbelievable. I mean, this is like cold out of a science fiction movie. It's like that movie The Thing or something.
Right.
Why don't we talk about something else, so we'll have something else to talk about. Not your shock treatment childhood, or your split personality. Not the smile, the clock misery. Not the things you do if you could. Why don't we talk about something else? Why don't we talk about something else and see if we're able not to sound.
Outrageous Cherry's 2005 LP, Our Love Will Change the World, that was Why Don't We Talk About Something Else. And that's all the time we have for this week. I'd like to thank Matthew for talking with Stereo Hysteria. And if you'd like more updates about Outrageous Cherry, you can follow them on Facebook at facebook.com/OutrageousCherryDetroit. Be sure to tune in again next week when our topic will be gerunds. This is Charlie, signing off.